Morning, brethren and sisters. Brother Ewan made alluded to the fact that we are blessed to be able to gather together separate from the world. And indeed, that is what we are able to do. And particularly pertinent to us considerations of things like Zechariah and Daniel and the Apocalypse. Because in those books, in the sense in which is not presented too much, in some other books are the... is the urgent desire of servants like Zechariah to understand these things. They're things which the world has little interest in. Understanding these books, some of them are difficult, are things which the world has no interest in. But they're things which Zechariah was greatly interested in, and they're things which we should be greatly interested in. So last night, Brother Ewan introduced us to the book, the background being that Israel had been cast out of the land because of the rebellion, and were now in the process of being restored to the land, but it wasn't without any work on their part, and neither was it without any problem, as Brother Ewan referred us to last night. So we can commence then our consideration of the visions this morning, and interesting perhaps that, what the consideration of the first vision is. We've been introduced to the troublous times of Israel's restoration under Zerubbabel, Joshua, Ezra, Nehemiah, etc. And we saw what the problems were and what the form of encouragement was. It came through Haggai and it comes through Zechariah as well. Was the encouragement in the form of a promise that the wall and the city and the temple would be built? Well, yes. We would answer to the affirmative to that. But perhaps the greatest encouragement, I would suggest, came from the promise that ultimately all the enemies of God will be subdued and that righteousness would triumph. Perhaps this was a greater encouragement to the likes of Zerubbabel and Joshua than the proximate or incipient fulfillment that the wall and the temple would be built. Perhaps the promise of the great future that Israel would have would be an even greater encouragement to the likes of Zerubbabel than the promise that for now everything will work out. And I think that's possibly true for us as well. We look to, in the time of our trial, and perhaps wish that the trial would go away. And yet, maybe when we stop and think deeply about things, the greatest promise to us is the promise that all the things of this life will pass and that soon righteousness will triumph, and when we receive the victory and we will be clothed in white robes with palms in our hands, that perhaps is the greatest encouragement to us, as much as we may want the trial to go away as well. So perhaps then this was the picture of future triumph, was one of the greatest means of encouragement to Zechariah, and that's what we have presented to us in this first vision. It's the first of the seven night visions. Some suggest all the visions took place in one night. I don't know how you prove that. There may be a way of establishing that. I haven't researched that, but it's kind of immaterial. This is the first of the visions that we have to look at, the man among the myrtle trees. Essentially, what we have presented to us in all of Zechariah's visions is a delineation of the fall of man's dominion, the kingdom of men, and the establishment of Yahweh's dominion, the everlasting kingdom that will not be destroyed nor left to others. Remembering, of course, as we often refer to, that in Yahweh's eyes there are only two kingdoms. There's his kingdom, that's the kingdom of God, and we have, on the other hand, the kingdom of men. Yes, we see many kingdoms, but rather they're like the dukedoms of the Holy Roman Empire. They're not really separate kingdoms, because they're all established on the same principle. We have two principles of the establishment of kingdoms. We either have God's principles, or we have the principles of sin. And so we have two broad categories. And unfortunately, as is always the case, it's the same in the Apocalypse, to an extent, though very limited in detail, we have the same in Daniel, and we certainly have the same in Zechariah, interspersed among this, within this glorious picture of God's triumph over his enemies and over Israel and, Israel's enemies, we have alluded to the departure of Israel from God's ways. Natural Israel in Zechariah and spiritual Israel in the Apocalypse. So, verse 7 then. Upon the 24th day of the 11th month, which is the month Sivat, in the second year of Darius, came the word of Yahweh unto Zechariah the son of Berechiah, the son of Iddo the prophet, saying, I saw by night, and behold, a man riding upon a red horse, and he stood among the myrtle trees that were in the bottom, and behind him were the red horses speckled and white. If we turn back a page to Haggai chapter 2, as Brother Ewan pointed out, we're in the same time period, Haggai and Zechariah, and the work was fundamentally to produce the same effect. Different messages, quite different messages actually, but they were all, both prophets were sent to encourage the people to return to the work of Yahweh in the building. Verse 18, consider now from this day and upward, from the 4th and 20th day of the 9th month, even from the day that the foundation of Yahweh's temple was laid, consider it. So where are we? In verse 10, the 4th and 20th day of the 9th month in the 2nd year of Darius. And if we turn to Zechariah chapter 1 verse 1, in the 8th month in the 2nd year of Darius came the word of Yahweh unto Zechariah. So we're in the 2nd year of Darius. So when we look at verse 7, the 4th and 20th day of the 11th month, we're exactly 2 months to the day after Haggai's prediction of future blessing on the completion of the foundation of the temple being laid. Sabbat is in the winter, which is approximately February, and as we know, in February, in this country certainly, we're sort of looking for the signs of spring. In Israel, the almond starts to blossom. So again, we have presented to us then, in the midst of Israel's wintry conditions and subservience to the Gentile powers, we have a vision just before the arrival of spring, a vision that would have been of comfort and encouragement. And perhaps the 24th day is significant in that we have alluded to as the Jew and Gentile redemption, not on Gentile premises, but on the Israelitish promises. The 12 tribes of Israel being multiplied by 2, being Jew and Gentile, on the hope of Israel, not on the hope of anything Gentile. The fact that the man stands among the myrtle trees leads us to a conclusion as to the time period of when this man is standing. Because what we have in myrtle trees, I think our minds will all jump to one thing when we think of myrtle trees, and that's the Feast of Tabernacles. But also we have some indication as to Israel's position at the time when we see myrtle trees mentioned. Let's turn to Isaiah chapter 5 verse 6 to demonstrate what we mean. Here we have predicted to us the time of Israel's downtreading and punishment for their disobedience. Isaiah chapter 5 verse 6 says, "And I will lay it waste, it shall not be pruned nor digged, but there shall come up briars and thorns. I will also command the clouds that they rain nor rain upon it." So a barren, unfruitful, hostile environment is to be, was the prediction of Israel's punishment. And 2,500 to 3,000 years after these prophecies, we can see that that is certainly been the case. But this is not the end proposed, as we know. Isaiah chapter 55 verse 13 presents a very different picture to us. Isaiah 55 verse 13, "Instead of the thorn shall come up the fir tree, and instead of the briar shall come up the myrtle tree. And it shall be to Yahweh for a name, for an everlasting sign, that shall not be cut off." So when we see the myrtle tree presented to us, as we do in Zechariah chapter 1, we have in mind the time of Israel's deliverance and their ultimate triumph over the nations of the world. But as we said, we can't help thinking of the Feast of Tabernacles when we think of the myrtle trees. The first time myrtle trees are mentioned is actually in Nehemiah chapter 8 verse 15, which we won't turn to now. When under Nehemiah they kept the Feast of Tabernacles on the return from Babylon. Evidently, myrtle trees would have been used previous to this, but were not mentioned explicitly. Evidently, it seems to be associated with restoration. We won't turn there either, but if we look at Leviticus chapter 23, we read that they were to make booths of the trees which were around them, and a myrtle tree being a relatively common tree in Israel, myrtle trees would have been used. But perhaps the fact that it's not mentioned explicitly until Nehemiah chapter 8 is perhaps an indication in itself that the myrtle is not just an indication in isolation of Israel's blessedness, but perhaps it's an indication of Israel's restoration to blessedness after their time of disobedience. Remember, in Exodus, they had only just received, and Leviticus, they'd only just received the law and the covenant from God. They were it was a new creation, if you like. In Nehemiah chapter 8, they'd already had their chance, and they'd blown their chance, as we know, and were subsequently taken into captivity. And the myrtle tree was explicitly mentioned in Nehemiah chapter 8 in their restoration. So, again, what we perhaps have here presented to us is a picture of Israel, not just their blessedness, but their restoration based on the time of Jacob's trouble having passed upon them, and they will have learnt, they will have had that heart of stone replaced with a heart of flesh. And consequent upon that, consequent upon their acceptance of God's new covenant that he would make with them, they would be blessed. And so we see this man standing among the myrtle trees. Who is this man? Well, he can only represent Christ, we believe. All things under the law pointed forward to Christ. Whether we think of the offerings, whether we think of the furniture of the tabernacles, or whether we think of the high priest himself, everything under the law pointed forward to Christ. Within those types, of course, we have the multitudinous Christ. But first and foremost, we have the man, as Christ presented to us. Now, the Feast of the Tabernacles was the last feast of the year. It was celebrated in the seventh month, and seventh being completeness, we have before us then something which is being completed. What has been completed? Evidently the work of the rejuvenating of the nations and the restoration of the tabernacle of David, which has fallen down, when Christ shall sit on David's throne. So this is the completion that we refer to in the Feast of Tabernacles, and we saw that in our study earlier on in the year. Throughout the Feast of Israel's year, we have presented to us the sort of process in which the kingdom will be established. We won't go into that now, but we remember the Feast of Pentecost, of Resurrection and First Fruits. We had the Day of Atonement, the day in which affliction would be unleashed upon the world, when the Aeonian Gospel would have been sent forth and refused for the most part, and so there would be a day of affliction, followed by the Feast of Tabernacles, which is when the work of subjugation is complete and the work of the redemption of Israel and the nations has been established. As you said, there is a final ingathering accompanied on this month. The blowing of the trumpet, the day of joy, followed swiftly by this day of atonement, which is the day of wrath of El Shaddai. But after that, as we say, the day of atonement, after the day of atonement comes the Feast of Tabernacles. And it is only then that the nations will be able to dwell safely in the booths, in thankfulness to Yahweh for his goodness. For, as we know, only when his judgments in the earth will the inhabitants of the world learn righteousness. Then will they be able to dwell in booths of thankfulness. And so this man among the myrtle trees suggests, and this is not how every expositor sees it, but I personally can't see it any other way, this time has to be after the judgments. We have the red horses, speckled and white, but I believe that the horses presented to us there are post-judgment. The work of judgment is evident in the horses, but I don't believe that the horses are ready to go forth to execute the judgment, but rather after judgment. And Brother Thomas comes to our aid, and he says, these considerations, that is, the consideration of the myrtles being linked to the Feast of Tabernacles, these considerations fix the time of Zechariah's horses at rest at the Feast of Tabernacles first ensuing, when the Holy One of Israel, the man on the red horse, shall have completed his conquest and shall be Prince of Peace in the midst of Israel. So, we would suggest that what Brother Thomas says is in harmony with the verses that follow. Verse 10 says, the man that stood among the myrtle trees answered and said, these are they whom Yahweh hath sent to walk to and fro through the earth. And they answered the angel of Yahweh that stood among the myrtle trees and said, we have walked to and fro through the earth, and behold, all the earth sitteth still and is at rest. That cannot be accomplished before the the great day of El Shaddai, nor the war of 30 years with the beast, but afterwards. So this man among the myrtle trees then stands after the judgments have been executed and the nations have been made subservient to Yahweh, his anointed. So the horses then. Horses represent war. Perhaps today we think of a horse and we think of the Grand National or something. Such a picture of horses would have been alien to Old Testament times. The horse was a symbol of power. The more horses one had in his military inventory, the more powerful he would have been regarded. The horse was a symbol of power and war. So the man upon the red horse, with other horses behind, indicate affliction upon all who the horses visit. Let's quickly turn to Zechariah chapter 10. And we read in verse 3, "Mine anger was kindled against the shepherds, and I punished the goats, for Yahweh Tzevaoth hath visited his flock, the house of Judah, and hath made them as his goodly horse in the battle." So the horse is not just a picture of war we have here, but it's a picture of military conquest. The man upon the red horse. Isaiah 63 says, "Who is this that cometh from Edom with dyed garments from Bozrah, and this that is glorious in his apparel, travelling in the greatness of his strength? I that speak in righteousness, mighty to save. Wherefore art thou red in thine apparel, and thy garments like him that treadeth in the winefat? I have trodden the winepress alone, and of the people there was none with me. For I will tread them in mine anger, and trample them in my fury, and their blood shall be sprinkled upon my garments, and I will stain all my raiment." So this man upon the red horse then is quite evidently Christ, who will come not just to deliver Israel, as we have seen in Isaiah chapter 63, but to judge the nations. But he has with him red horses, speckled and white. The red horses, as we've seen, are indicative of bloodshed. And the man, that's Christ, sat on the red horse. And yet there were red horses behind him, which perhaps indicates that it would not just be the singular work of Christ. We understand that that Christ is not literally alone when he refers to himself, "I've trod the winepress alone," in Isaiah 63. He's trodden the winepress alone as a multitudinous Christ. Israel has no part in that deliverance. They will have a part to play in the subsequent war against flesh. But in the initial subduing of the Gorgian host, Christ and the saints will be alone. And so we have then perhaps presented to us here that the red horses are the work of Christ and the saints, who will be to take the sword to God's enemies. The chariots that we have related to us later on in Zechariah aren't referred to here. And perhaps that's because the chariots, under that vision, refers to the work of Christ and the saints through Israel. But here, we have to realise that it's the work of God that is performing the judgments written. It's not in Israel's strength. Yes, they are God's battle axe and weapon of war. But it's only due to this man that stands among the myrtle trees. The victory is not Israel's. It is God and his sons. The horse, so we have red horses representing bloodshed. Speckled horses, or also translated bay horses, which is a sort of a reddish brown. It's the word saruk from sharak, which sharak means to be shrill. And therefore, by implication, apparently, it can be translated brown with red spots. We might think that this is perhaps the red spots of bloodshed. Alternatively, I think perhaps this may relate perhaps to the element of disease. If we think of Leviticus chapter 13, where we have a reddish sore indicated on the forehead, representing leprosy. So perhaps what we have here is the red horse is representing bloodshed, and the speckled or bay horse, or brown with bright red spots, indicating the disease that would directly be inflicted and indirectly as a result of war, because we know that war brings much disease with it. And we know that the disease will claim the lives of millions at this time of trouble. In actual fact, Habakkuk chapter 3, in verse 3 says, Eloah came from Teman and the Holy One from Mount Paran. His glory covered the heavens, and the earth was full of his praise, and his brightness was as the light. He had horns coming out of his hand, and there was the hiding of his power. Before him went the pestilence, and burning coals went forth at his feet. He stood and measured the earth. He beheld and drove asunder the nations, and the everlasting mountains were scattered. The perpetual hills did bow. His ways are everlasting. Burning coals there is the word resheph, and that's the burning heat of disease. So perhaps then, maybe what we have presented to us in the speckled horses is the disease that would accompany the judgments in the day of El Shaddai. And we have white horses, Laban, which we would suggest represents victory. Let's turn to the Apocalypse, chapter 19. Well-known verses. Apocalypse chapter 19 and verse 11. And I saw heaven opened, and behold, a white horse, and he that sat upon him was called Faithful and True, and in righteousness he doth judge and make war. His eyes were as a flame of fire, and on his head were many crowns, and he had a name written that no man knew but he himself, and he was clothed with a vesture dipped in blood, and his name is called the Word of God. And the armies which are in heaven followed him upon white horses, clothed in fine linen, white and clean, and out of his mouth goeth a sharp sword, that with it he should smite the nations, and he should rule them with a rod of iron, and he treadeth the winepress of the fierceness and wrath of Almighty God, and he hath on his vesture, and on his name, sorry, and on his thigh, a name written, King of Kings, and Lord of Lords. And also, as we're here, we can look briefly at Apocalypse chapter 3 and verse 5. He that overcometh, the same shall be clothed in white raiment. So I think the predominant feature of the white horses is victory. But perhaps we also have linked within there that the judgments are righteous. In the Apocalypse we have presented to us that true and righteous are thy judgments. So perhaps we have the element of victory and also the element that the judgments are right and true. Verse 10 of Zechariah chapter 1, and the man that stood among the myrtle trees answered and said, these are they whom Yahweh hath sent to walk to and fro through the earth. And they answered the angel of Yahweh that stood among the myrtle trees and said, we have walked to and fro through the earth, and behold, all the earth sitteth still and is at rest. It's incredible, as we've often said, we refer to it when we read a book in Sunday school, the Temple of Ezekiel's Prophecy. The scriptures of truth appeal to the human mind. It's not like the faith of the apostasy. The reward to sit on clouds playing harps is, I suppose, better than death, but that's about all that can be said about it. There's nothing idle about the hope of the gospel. Our hope has nothing in it which makes it seem as if we'd be lazy, sitting about, relaxing, chilling out, and with all the time in the world to kill. The hope that we have is of being busy and of being engaged in the work of God from dawn till dusk, so to speak. They walked to and fro through the earth. The activity in divine work is the hope of the faithful. That's interesting. Yahweh knows everything. He hardly needs men and women to walk through the earth and perform his work. But that's the way he has chosen to work. Because God manifestation, not human salvation, is the great theme of the Eternal Spirit. He delights for his creation to do his work, to manifest his work on earth. And so we have then the work of Christ and the saints, with of course God's power, to bring the earth into God's command. These, as Brother Thomas says, are those which, where he says, we are told that the seven burnings are the eyes of Yahweh, which leads to the conclusion that the lampstand with its bowls and pipes is representative of Yahweh as manifested in David's son and his brethren. they walked throughout the earth. And again, we're automatically led to think of the Apocalypse chapter 5 and verse 6, if we turn there quickly. Apocalypse chapter 5, verse 6, "And I beheld, and lo, in the midst of the throne, and of the four beasts, and in the midst of the elders, stood a lamb, as it had been slain, having seven horns and seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God, sent forth into all the earth." They're not sent forth just to analyze the situation. They're sent forth to accomplish God's purpose. This, then, what we have presented to us, as we've already said, is the sea of glass phase in the establishment of the kingdom. The subjugation of the nations is complete in readiness for the re-establishment of the tabernacle of David. Verse 12 of Zechariah chapter 1, "Then the angel of Yahweh answered and said, O Yahweh Tzevaoth, how long wilt thou not have mercy on Jerusalem and on the cities of Judah, against which thou hast had indignation these 80 years? And Yahweh answered, The angel that talked with me with good words and comfortable words. So the angel that came out to me said unto me, Cry thou, saying, Thus saith Yahweh Tzevaoth, I am jealous for Jerusalem and for Zion with a great jealousy, and I am very sore displeased with the heathen that are at ease, for I was but a little displeased, and they held forward the affliction. Therefore thus saith Yahweh, I am returned to Jerusalem with mercies. My house shall be built in it, saith Yahweh Tzevaoth, and the line shall be stretched forth upon Jerusalem. Cry yet, saying, Thus saith Yahweh Tzevaoth, My cities through prosperity shall yet be spread abroad, and Yahweh shall yet comfort Zion, and shall yet choose Jerusalem." How could these be words of comfort for the world? They can only be words of comfort for a very small class, the Zechariah class. Those who desire the establishment of God's will concerning his people and his plan of restoration for all the earth. Those who look for the time when the nations will be blessed in Abraham, the Israelite, the Hebrew. Not blessed in anything Gentile, but blessed in Abraham, who was called of God and was the friend of God. This is a small class of people who find comfort in such words. Such words which predict the re-establishment of Jerusalem and when God will have favour upon Zion. In fact, what were the last words of the apostles to Christ? Lord, wilt thou at this time restore again the kingdom to Israel? It's a question which, no matter how much the churches try to claim they follow the apostles, it's a question that is of extremely little interest to them. But it's a question that is of great interest to Zechariah, the apostles, John, and of great interest to us. For therein lies our redemption, and therein lies the hope of a rejuvenated earth. Even though Zechariah lived in a time of restoration, as Brother Ewan pointed out to us last night, it was a time of trouble. It was, to use the words of Zechariah, a day of small things. The glory of Yahweh was still absent. The land was without a king. The restoration work was not without its problems. Some of the problems were very great problems, to the point where the process of rebuilding was actually halted. It was indeed not a day of glory. Despite the fact that it was a day of restoration, we can sometimes look back at this and see it as the glorious restoration, but there was much missing. And so it was natural for one like Zechariah, someone like he who was fully convicted and zealous for the hope of Israel, to empathize with the question of verse 12, O Yahweh Tzevaoth, how long wilt thou not have mercy on Jerusalem and on the cities of Judah, against which thou hast had indignation these 80 years? It's not Zechariah who answered the question, it was the angel that was with him. But the angel would have emulated Zechariah's thoughts. As we've said, Zechariah, Daniel and John were isolated cases. They weren't the common run-of-the-mill people. And even among God's people, even among Zechariah's compatriots, there were many who were more concerned for the present things, the things of ease, rather than the things of God. This was and is especially the case among the Gentiles. They're pleasantly occupied with their own prosperities. I am very sore displeased with the heathen authorities, For I was but a little displeased, and they helped forward the affliction. How much do we see that today? When we see Jerusalem and God's people compassed about with multiple nations who would love to see their destruction. And what do the nations of the world think about it? Not a whole lot. They're more content to carry on with their own licentious ways than worry about the things of God's people. The words of comfort are there for us, to be reminded that God is displeased at the indifferent attitude of the Gentiles to the plight of his people. That the nations are indifferent, if not positively hostile, is something that has come to the attention of Israel's God. While the time of Jacob's trouble approaches, even many in Israel are at ease, just like Zechariah's day, more content to dwell in their sealed houses, ensuring that their own little lives are comfortable than do the work of God. Jerusalem, as we know, is a subject of much debate in world politics. And Jerusalem very rarely comes out positively in the media. Phrases like occupied territories, apartheid state, Al-Quds, etc. are all used in high political circles. No wonder that God says, I am jealous for Jerusalem, I've designed with a great jealousy, I am very sore displeased with the heathen that are at ease, and it held forward the affliction. These things do not pass unnoticed to God. And just a word on jealous, not that any of us are unaware of this, but Brother Robert says in Law of Moses, jealousy is displeasure at preference shown for another. In man, this may be and usually is a petty and unenlightened and unreasonable feeling. It usually results from a desire to be preferred without reference to the well-being of those who may be affected. It has no basis beyond the instinct that enables us to find pleasure in being approved and respected. A most useful instinct in this place, but ignoble and hurtful as a ruling motive. But with God, the sentiment of jealousy stands upon a totally different footing. You see, Yahweh has chosen Jerusalem to be the city of the great king, the city in which his name should dwell. It is right for him to be jealous for Jerusalem. He, as the creator of heaven and earth, has a right to be jealous for that city which he has chosen for his name to dwell in. Therefore, the Gentiles who help forward the affliction of this city and people incur the wrath of he who has declared that Jerusalem shall be the throne of Yahweh, Jeremiah 3. So in itself then, it is comforting to know that Yahweh sees and is very sore displeased. And this word displeased has also been rendered in the King James Version, wrath or anger. So very sore displeased may be a slight understatement, although to be on the side of, to be in a position where God is very displeased at us is not exactly a good situation to be in, however you want to take it. But the fact is that God is very sore wroth with the nations. This in itself is a comfort. But in addition, his plans provide even more comfort for us and for Zechariah in his day of affliction, in the struggles that he had. Particularly, we think of Zerubbabel and the builders of the wall. Verse 16, I am returned to Jerusalem with mercies. My house shall be built in it, saith Yahweh Tzevaoth, and a line shall be stretched forth upon Jerusalem. Cry yet, saying, thus saith Yahweh Tzevaoth, my city through prosperity shall yet be spread abroad, and Yahweh shall yet comfort Zion, and shall yet choose Jerusalem. Rotherham renders the first part there, where we read, my city through prosperity shall yet be spread abroad. Rotherham renders that, my cities shall overflow with blessings. So the day of desolation is at an end. It has an end. The day of comfort is fixed and hastens with every hastening year. Isaiah 66 says, for thus saith Yahweh, behold, I will extend peace to her like a river, and the glory of the Gentiles like a flowing stream. Then shall ye suck. Ye shall be born upon her sides and be dandled upon her knees, as one whom his mother comforteth. So will I comfort you, and ye shall be comforted in Jerusalem. And earlier on in his prophecy, chapter 40, verse 1, comfort ye my people, saith your God. Speak ye comfortably to Jerusalem, and cry unto her, that her warfare is accomplished, and her iniquity is pardoned. For she hath received of Yahweh's hand double for all his sins. And Brother Philip chose that psalm that we sang in opening, Psalm 102 verse 13, Thou shalt arise and have mercy upon Zion, for the time to favour her, yea, the set time is come. Yahweh's mercy returned in the days of Zechariah, and consequently the temple was built. But we know that this was not a permanent fixture. It was not a permanent fulfilment of Yahweh's mercy returning to Israel. The permanent and ultimate fulfilment is yet future. And we won't talk very much upon the line that's talked about in verse 16. It's the word quaff that we're familiar with because of the when we read the Temple of Ezekiel's prophecy. It's a measured line. It's not necessarily a measuring line, although it can be a measuring line. It's a line which has been measured. In other words, it's a time limit. It's basically something that Zechariah would have seen as having a limit. It's a line which has been measured, not a line to measure, if we can understand the difference. The power of Yahweh's words is not so much in the length of the measurement, for Zechariah would have had no idea just how long Jerusalem's downtreading would extend until. The comfort and the encouragement and the power of Yahweh's words was in the fact that there is a terminus. There is a set time to favour Zion. Jeremiah 30 verse 10 says, Therefore fear thou not, O my servant Jacob, saith Yahweh, neither be dismayed, O Israel. For lo, I will save thee from afar, and thy seed from the land of their captivity. And Jacob shall return, and shall be in rest, and be quiet, and none shall make him afraid. For I am with thee, saith Yahweh, to save thee. Though I make a full end of all nations whither I have scattered thee, yet will I not make a full end of thee. But I will correct thee in measure, and will not leave thee altogether unpunished. And again, the next chapter of Jeremiah, Thus saith Yahweh, if heaven above can be measured, and the foundations of the earth searched out beneath, I will also cast off all the seed of Israel for all that they have done, saith Yahweh. Behold, the days come, saith Yahweh, that the city shall be built to Yahweh from the tower of Hananel unto the gate of the quarter, and the measuring line shall yet go forth over again, sit upon the hill Gareb, and shall compass about to Goath. And lastly, Psalm 80, verse 17, Let thy hand be upon the man of thy right hand, upon the Son of Man, whom thou madest strong for thyself. So will not we go back from thee. Quicken us, and we will call upon thy name. Turn us again, Yahweh Elohim Tzevaoth. Cause thy face to shine, and we shall be saved. Let's quickly turn to Micah chapter 7, before we move on to the next vision, the second of the visions. Micah chapter 7 and verse 16. The nations shall see and be confounded at all their might. They shall lay their hands upon their mouth, their ears shall be deaf. They shall lick the dust like a serpent. They shall move out of their holes like worms of the earth. They shall be afraid of Yahweh our Elohim, and shall fear because of thee. Whom is an ail like unto thee, that pardoneth iniquity, and passeth by the transgression of the remnant of his heritage? He retaineth not his anger for ever, because he delighteth in mercy. He will turn again, he will have compassion upon us. He will subdue our iniquities, and thou wilt cast all their sins into the depths of the sea. Thou wilt perform the truth to Jacob, and the mercy to Abraham, which thou hast sworn, and to our fathers from the days of old. And with that then, with those verses, we can now proceed to the second of the visions in verse 18 of Zechariah chapter 1. Then lifted I up mine eyes and saw, and behold, four horns. And I said unto the angel that talked with me, What be these? And he answered me, These are the horns which have scattered Judah, Israel, and Jerusalem. And Yahweh showed me four carpenters. Then said I, What come these to do? And he spake, saying, These are the horns which have scattered Judah, so that no man did lift up his hand. But these are come to fray them, to cast out the horns of the Gentiles which lifted up their horn over the land of Judah to scatter it. Horns, as we know, are indicative of power. The power of a bull, or a ram, or a goat, or even a deer is in the horns. And it's presented in the Bible as the power of a conqueror. Hence, we see the ram in Daniel chapter 8, extending his power through his horns. It was the horns that was his power of conquest, symbolically. And equally, his horns were ultimately broken. It was his power which was broken by the goat with his notable horn. And it was the notable horn that was prominent in the feature of the goat in subduing the power of the ram. So horns then are indicative of power, particularly the power of a conquering nation or individual. We equally have the same with the lamb as it had been slain. We want to look then, turn in now in Apocalypse chapter 5. We saw the lamb that it had been slain with seven horns and seven eyes. They're not for show in the scriptures. It's not just to show someone who's great and mighty. It's to show that the horns are there to conquer and subdue. And so what we have presented to us here then are four horns of the Gentiles. And again, as a sort of a side comment, we don't hear we're not dealing with the British Empire or even the Mongol Empire or anything like that. The horns that are presented to us here are horns that, one, relate to God's people Israel, and secondly, the horns that relate to the kingdom of men, the opposition to God as he establishes his kingdom on the earth. We can all easily identify these four horns with the four beasts of Daniel and the empires of the image and the four metals. Zechariah then, in seeing these horns, bearing in mind he was only living under the second beast dominion, the Persian, the bear. He was living under the second horn, if you like. He would have known that there would have been some time to go before Israel's restoration could have been effected. The four horns were to break and scatter Judah, which we know they did. Wouldn't be altogether true to say that the Persian Empire broke and scattered Israel as such, but we know that they didn't rebuild the tabernacle of David. When Israel were restored under Zerubbabel, Ezra and Nehemiah, they did not promote the restoration of a king. That king, as God had predicted, would be, or the kingdom would be overturned, until he comes right it is, and God would in due course give it to him. There was to be no king under the Persian Empire. And as we know, as Brother Ewan mentioned last night, under Smoothest the Magian, they were actually prevented from rebuilding the temple. So it is true to say that the Persians were a subduing power over the Jews. They held the Jews in subjection. They weren't anti-Semitic in that sense, but they were a horn power over God's people. To the point in verse 21 where we see that no man did lift up his head, by which we believe is meant that no one could lift up his head as a ruler with impunity against the power of either Persia, Greece, or Rome, and certainly not under the Babylonians, as we know they took them captive. And even today, Israel is not free to exercise their discretion on their internal affairs without interference. They can't even manage their own internal security without interference from the UN. We believe it goes much deeper than this, because we believe that the horn refers to a ruler, not some democratic state which Israel enjoys today. Ultimately, there is no horn in Israel. But we obviously realise that when Christ, the Lamb that had been slain, stands up with seven horns and seven eyes, he will be the conqueror as Israel's king. So we have then the four horns presented to us as those who would subdue Israel and have subdued them, but also, as we know in the image of Daniel chapter 2, these four empires don't stand up in the vision as four historically distinct empires. They have their origins in those four historically distinct empires, but in the image of that Nebuchadnezzar saw, they stand up as one colossus, united by thick clay. In this arrangement of things, they will exercise their greatest effort ever to scatter and destroy Judah and Israel one last time before we had introduced to the four carpenters, which again was a source of encouragement to Zechariah. The word of God is not one of all fluffy and comforting words. There's realism presented to us. We're never presented as that old sister used to say, we've never been promised a magic carpet ride into the kingdom. Oh, there's a poem, I can't think of it, about skies ever blue. That's not the life in the truth that the scriptures present to us. The churches around us would like us to think that our life in Christianity is one of pleasure and of great success. That's never been the presentation of the truth. And it was never the presentation to Zechariah. He wasn't told all beautiful things. He was presented with a picture of Israel being subdued. And later on, as we know, with the harlot and the ephah, etc., even Israel's apostasy, which would have been a tragic consideration for him. But he was presented with the encouragement that despite these things, the end would come when God would favour Zion and when ungodliness would be turned away from Jacob. And so we are introduced to the four carpenters who would pray the power of the four horns. What an encouraging picture to Zechariah. How topical that would have been to him. Perhaps not in his living memory, but certainly his parents' memory would have been the captivity of Babylon. And the dwelling in the land of Babylon and Persia. And then they return to the land to build the temple. And even then, not without difficulties. So how great would this encouragement have been that one day these Gentile powers who have no interest or understanding of the hope of Israel, which he shared, would be destroyed. With all his fear from enemies around, Israel being devoid of their own sovereignty, this would have been a great encouragement only to someone like Zechariah, Zerubbabel, Haggai, Joshua, Ezra, Nehemiah, those who had the faith to look beyond the present time. As an interesting, well, it's not that interesting really, but the revised version has spoiled the illusion representing carpenters. The word there is karashim, which is, and they've rendered it smiths. Perhaps there's some weight to that translation. But a writer in the Christadelphian said, one would think the revisers had never heard of the carpenter who is to be king over all the earth. It is true that the word carries a wider meaning than our word carpenter, and wider also than smith. But the tectonus of the Septuagint rightly points to the tecton, carpenter, of the New Testament, and properly indicates the ruling power to come. And I find myself concurring with that interpretation. I don't think anything can be more fitting, in many ways, than the presentation of carpenter. At the end of the day, we are struck by the Apocalypse, chapter 5. What was the power that destroyed the Gentiles? It wasn't some magnificent lion, the biggest that we'd ever saw. It was a lamb that had been slain. God is made strong in weakness. We don't have to look too far throughout Scripture to see how, through humility, God gains the victory. In Matthew chapter 13, verse 55, those of Nazareth said, "Is not this the carpenter's son?" And we know that as a result of that, Christ could do no mighty works in Nazareth because of their unbelief, because they despised the carpenter's son. The carpenters, we believe, represent Christ and the saints in warlike aspect. And Brother Thomas in Fanarosa says these horns represent the same thing as the four cherubim, the four carpenters, and the four living ones of Ezekiel, Zechariah, and John, only in the brazen stage which precedes the golden olam or millennium. As horns of brass, they execute the judgments written as a consuming fire, for brass and offering by fire are the association of things in the type. End of quote. So, we don't just have four carpenters presented as a general picture to us. What we have is the four carpenters as the conquerors and the destroyers of these four horns. The link to the four cherubim, the four living ones, and the four horns particularly not the horns, the horns on the brazen altar we think of, because Brother Thomas says, as horns of brass, they execute the judgment written. And we think of Solomon, who executed judgment over Adonijah and Joab, who both caught horns, caught hold of the horns of the altar. So Christ and the carpenter community will exercise judgment over the horns of the world's powers in the brazen state, not in the golden state, in the brazen state, the flaming fire that goes forth to burn up all that do wickedly. The word Frey is Charad, which is the same word used in Exodus chapter 19, verse 18, where we read, "And Mount Sinai was altogether on a smoke, because Yahweh descended upon it in fire. And the smoke thereof ascended as the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mount quaked greatly." That's the same word, the word quake. And again, in 1 Samuel chapter 13, "When the men of Israel saw that they were in a strait," this is in the days of Saul, when Jonathan had destroyed some of the Philistine warriors, for the people were distressed, "then the people did hide themselves in caves, and in thickets, and in rocks, and in high places, and in pits. And some of the Hebrews went over Jordan to the land of Gad and Gilead. As for Saul, he was yet in Gilgal, and all the people followed him trembling." So, Frey there, from a sort of English word, afraid, meaning to weaken by fraying, possibly could be rendered quaking or trembling. This is the work of the carpenters. Why do we have four carpenters presented to us? I don't think we have to spend too much time thinking about this, but it's still interesting. Why four? We read in the Christadelphian in 1886. "There being four Gentile horns, a carpenter for each horn is appropriate. But the principal reason doubtless lies in the four-camp organization of Israel's host when they came out of Egypt, a matter of divine arrangement with typical forecasts. This division of the camp into four gave an analogical relation to the Commonwealth of Israel in its final aspect as a city lying four square, and also yielded four cherubic living creatures as the symbol of divine organization, corresponding antagonistically to the four beasts into which the camp of human Satanism has been historically divided." So again, it's not difficult to identify the number four, in this case, with the encampment of Israel, which we know was split into four, with Judah, Reuben, Ephraim and Dan as the leading tribes in the encampment, and they were divided into four as they encamped around the tabernacle. We know as well that the sun was made to shine on the fourth day of creation, which points forward to the light of the world, who at this very time predicted here is actually laying down a new creation in the earth, when the whole earth will be rejuvenated on godly principles. The number four, when we think of the time period Zechariah lived in, for a long time the nations had been divided. The ten tribes were no more as far as a national entity was concerned. But perhaps Zechariah being presented with four, he might have thought of the future when the 12 tribes would be no more two nations, but be united under the Messiah. Now, what's interesting, and Brother Roberts spends quite some time in his exhortations thinking about things like this, he speaks about the reversal of things, in that those who are great now will be subdued in the time to come, if not destroyed. Those who are weak and made poor for Christ's sake will be made rich and powerful in the kingdom to come. And Brother Roberts goes to length in various of his exhortations and writings to demonstrate that effect. Now, if we were to look at Isaiah chapter 66, verse 2, we have the well-known words, "To this man will I look, even to him that is poor, and of a contrite spirit, and trembleth at my word." That word "trembleth" there is that same word charad, to fray, that we have, translated fray here. So, the same word that is related to those who are poor and of a contrite spirit, and who sort of tremble at God's word, will then go forth and shine as the glory of the heavens, and execute the judgment written so that then it will be the nations, it will be the four horn powers that will be trembling, which I think is a beautiful intended irony. Those who make light of God and His word now will be made to tremble and quake, whereas those who have revered God and His word will be constituents of the four carpenters that will make the nations quake and tremble. And without dwelling too much then on the work of the carpenter to destroy, because a carpenter, by its very natural definition, is one who builds. But essentially it's like a carpenter going into an old house which is rotten and derelict. First, there has to be destruction and removal before there can be rebuilding and rejuvenation. Isaiah chapter 26, verse 9, "For when thy judgments are in the earth, the inhabitants of the world will learn righteousness." And let's turn to Isaiah chapter 41, which is a beautiful chapter in relation to Israel's restoration. Isaiah 41 and verse 10, "Fear thou not, for I am with thee. Be not dismayed, for I am thy Elohim. I will strengthen thee. Yea, I will help thee. Yea, I will uphold thee with the right hand of thy righteousness. Behold, all they that were incensed against thee shall be ashamed and confounded. They shall be as nothing, and they that strive with thee shall perish. Thou shalt seek them, and shalt not find them. Even them that contended with thee, they that war against thee, shall be as nothing, and as a thing of naught. For I, Yahweh, the Elohim, will hold thy right hand, saying unto thee, Fear not, I will help thee. Fear not, thou womb Jacob, and ye men of Israel. I will help thee, saith Yahweh, and thy Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel. Behold, thou make thee a new sharp threshing instrument, having teeth. Thou shalt thresh the mountains, and beat them small, and shalt make the hills as chaff. Thou shalt fan them, and the wind shall carry them away, and the whirlwind shall scatter them, and thou shalt rejoice in Yahweh, and shalt glory in the Holy One of Israel." This is the work of the carpenter, and the four carpenters as Christ's brethren. And the aspect of a carpenter is very interesting. We know that there are many symbols which relate to the building trade in the book of Zechariah, which we know was applicable to the time of Zechariah because of the building work that the nation was engaged in, building the temple particularly. The saints are elsewhere represented by horns, as we've said in Apocalypse chapter 5. And equally, Christ is referred to in Luke chapter 1 as the horn of salvation. But in Zechariah's day, perhaps in his day of affliction, and when Zerubbabel and the leaders of the people were felt beset about with problems, perhaps the encouraging picture was that this is a day of small things, and it is those who have endured in the day of small things that will become great and will execute the judgments. Perhaps the presentation of a horn or something like that would have been a little more distant to Zechariah. But to see four carpenters presented as the symbol of those who would break the horns would have been about as encouraging as I think it could possibly have been. Encouragement then was that Zechariah and the faithful, like Zerubbabel, Ezra, Nehemiah, and the faithful in his day, was that though a remnant, a small remnant, weak and feeble, the rebuilding of Israel's commonwealth would be brought about, not by might nor by power, but by my spirit, saith Yahweh Tzevaoth. And equally for us, the ultimate triumph over the enemies of the truth would be brought about to those who came out of great tribulation and have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Isaiah 66 verse 2, "To this man will I look, even to him that is poor and of a contrite spirit, and trembleth at my word." 2 Corinthians 12 verse 9, "And he said unto me, My grace is sufficient for thee, for my strength is made perfect in weakness." 2 Corinthians 13 verse 4, "For though he was crucified through weakness, yet he liveth by the power of God." How great would this encouragement have been to the people in Zechariah's time, labouring under the might of Persia, not to see four horns contesting, but to see four humble carpenters destroy the power of the four proud and haughty horns. Psalm 149. "Praise ye Yahweh. Sing unto Yahweh a new song, and his praise in the congregation of saints. Let Israel rejoice in him that made him. Let the children of Zion be joyful in their king. Let them praise his name in the dance. Let them sing praises unto him with a timbrel and harp. For Yahweh taketh pleasure in his people. He will beautify the meek with salvation. Let the saints be joyful in glory, let them sing aloud upon their beds. Let the high praises of Baal be in their mouth, and a two-edged sword in their hand, to execute vengeance upon the heathen and punishments upon the people, to bind their kings with chains and their nobles with fetters of iron, to execute upon them the judgment written. Dishonour have all his saints. Praise ye Yahweh. Yahweh taketh pleasure in his people. He will beautify the meek with salvation. Not the proud, the meek, the humble carpenter community will be those who Yahweh will take pleasure in and will be blessed to go forth and execute the judgment written. As a point to note, the world only sees the carpenter aspect. They don't see the future for that community. They only ever see Brother Thomas and his companions, a capable doctor wasting his opportunities, disappearing off the world of medicine and from the historic page, choosing an arduous life for the sake of the truth, when he could have been riding around Richmond in the finest carriage. This is how the world sees the carpenter. They don't see what we see and what the Zechariah class can see, that the future is glorious and that Yahweh will beautify the meek and take pleasure in them. And it's even the same at the time of the end, really. Yes, as we discussed this Thursday, the Thursday previous, the nations will know that the victor who destroys Gog in the Middle East is not just any victor. They will be given the opportunity to walk by faith and not by sight. But at the same time, they will ask the question, is not this the carpenter's son? In other words, is not this the Antichrist? And they will be offended at him. The visible power will be restrained, as we know. Yet they will have the opportunity. They will be able to see that this is something special. But they won't be given the opportunity to see that power unleashed in all its manifestation. And so even then, they will only see the carpenter class until the nations are subdued and the nations of the world will learn righteousness. Brother Robert says, kind of linking to what we referred to earlier on, working men are looked down upon by the children of plenty, and lo, a working man is destined to divest them of their wealth and send them empty away. That's from Nazareth Revisited and their beautiful words, which we've alluded to several times. And so then we conclude our remarks by thinking of Isaiah chapter 56, verse 1 and 6. Thus saith Yahweh, keep ye judgment and do justice, for my salvation is near to come, and my righteousness to be revealed. Blessed is the man that doeth this. Also the sons of the stranger that join themselves to Yahweh to serve him, and to love the name of Yahweh, to be his servants. Everyone that keepeth the Sabbath from polluting it, and taketh hold of my covenant, even them will I bring to my holy mountain, and make them joyful in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and their sacrifices shall be accepted upon mine altar, for mine house shall be called a house of prayer for all people. And we refer to Psalm 102 again. Thou shalt arise and have mercy upon Zion, for the time to favour her, yea, the set time is come. For thy servants take pleasure in her stones, and favour the dust thereof. And so we leave our considerations then of these visions, and await the return of the carpenter, who is to build as well as destroy. May we all, brethren and sisters, bear that name, and all the dishonours meanwhile associated with it, in the hope of being finally chosen for the real and ultimate work for which the carpenter community is being developed, a work of pulling down the evil and building the good, that the earth may be filled with joy to God and man.